Leslie's meditation is where I want to start, which is the question of consciousness. And this is the question in the book of Jonah. How does one's consciousness expand? How does it grow? You could ask yourself that as a question. Do I believe that my consciousness, my awareness, you could say, or my relationship to the world, can it grow? And interestingly enough, I'm a fan of Ken Wilber. I brought him up a bunch of times, but it's been a while. And he has sort of a simple way of framing the development of consciousness. And I'm going to give you the most simple, because there's really nothing simple about anything that Ken Wilber says. So I'll start in a small place, a simple place. If you want to go further, you can. So he says consciousness or consciousness development can look like the move from egocentric, that's I, ego is the Latin word for I, so egocentric, the I, which is necessary. If you've had children or ever been around a child, meaning all of you, you know at a certain point they develop the sense of I. Where does that come from? That's the beginning of the ego, of ego development. Without it, we're in real trouble, by the way. So egocentric consciousness is where we start early on. Sometime down the road, we develop what could be called an ethnocentric consciousness. Well, it's not just I and my world, or if I do this and I do that, it affects the world. Well, there's a group that I'm a part of, ethnocentric consciousness. That usually starts with the family or family of origin or the tiny tribe you might be a part of, but it often grows into a larger sense of we, whatever that we is. That's ethnocentric consciousness. And we all pass through it. We cannot bypass it. Nobody gets like a free pass to something else. If you don't develop ethnocentric consciousness, you're in real trouble. Because in the sense of, I don't know to whom I belong, and if I don't know to whom I belong, it's a much more scary and dangerous world. So ethnocentric consciousness. And then he says something, what he likes to call world-centric consciousness, becomes possible. So it's not just I, and it's not just we, but maybe there's a larger we, there's a larger us, there's a global world-centric possibility. Now, that's not as simple as like holding hands and playing We Are the World, you know? By the way, you should watch that video sometime and just look for Bob Dylan in there. I mean, he looks hilarious. He looks like he hates where he is, and he might be completely high. So it's worth watching, all right? But world-centric consciousness, don't think you gain it like intellectually. I mean, just start asking the question, how does consciousness shift in the first place? All right? And then Ken Wilber has something beyond that, has various names. I'm going to actually call it cosmos-centric consciousness, where there's something even beyond the us of the world, one human family, right? Now, one of the things that I will just put forth as a possibility is that there's no bypassing any of these things. And one of the things that Ken Wilber says, the higher state of consciousness you find yourself in, the easier it is, especially on the higher levels, to include all other levels of consciousness. Only early levels of consciousness reject previous levels of consciousness. Which, I'll give you an example. If you get to world-centric consciousness, most people are in world-centric consciousness, reject ethnocentric consciousness. They say, that's small-minded, that's tribal, we're not there anymore, we're all one human family, that kind of thing is old, that kind of thing is archaic. Ken Wilber says, watch out, you're not that far along as you think. Because if you get to some higher levels of consciousness, not that we can all be Buddha or something, you'll see how all levels belong. And all levels exist within the psyche, we could say. We never fully graduate from egocentric consciousness. How do I know that? Because if I did something that offended you and you flared up, I'd say, there it is. You wouldn't say, I'm cosmos-centric and we're all one and I can sense the energy vibes of unity between us. No? Suddenly you'd be self-protective. It happens. So don't think you ever fully graduate. It's something like You carry some complexity, which is what Leslie was pointing at. We are complex human beings. And growth is complex, and growth is challenging. It's very challenging, and we don't know exactly how our consciousness expands. But we can look around and say, well, some people seem to have an expanded consciousness and some people don't. Wouldn't you agree with that? So the question is how, why? And if I come back, you know, down from this conversation of consciousness and look at the book of Jonah, we could say something like this. What's the problem? We ask, what's the problem? Well, the problem is, I'll put it, run it through the Ken Wilber lens, Jonah seems to be stuck in ethnocentric consciousness. My tribe, my people, my God, my land. I don't know if they had a Bible then. I was going to say my Bible. They certainly had words that had been written down. The ethnocentric. And all gods in the ancient world, including Yahweh, were ethnic deities. They lived in geographical places. The idea that my own geographical deity might have something to do with another geographical place, that's a pretty radical idea for the ancient mind. When you were in Egypt, the Egyptian gods were in charge. When you were in Mesopotamia, the Mesopotamian gods were in charge. When you were in the land of Canaan, you know, Yahweh was in charge, you know. So that's a challenge to think, well, what does that people group have to do with me? What does that people group have to do with my God or my religion or my way of life? Now, why am I talking about this in the 21st century? Because we are still largely ethnocentric. My tribe. Even if we define tribe a little differently, like, well, you know, we don't have tribes. Well, we do, actually. But, you know, your tribe meaning your people, my peeps, you know, the people who are like me, who think like me and are educated like me and read the books that I read and watch the things that I watch. And the book of Jonah is just poking at this. So you think you know the way the world works. And if we put it in through a theological lens, which is certainly possible here in the book, the question is, does Yahweh care about other people? And Jonah doesn't want him to. Isn't that funny? And if you're really honest, do you want your enemies to repent or do you want them to perish? You know, do you want to include them or do you not want to include them? That's really the question. And if you're very honest, one part of you says, I don't want to include them. And Jonah's just a little more honest than you are. And he said, I would rather die than include these people in my worldview. Really? Kill me, he says. So, I'm going to mention just briefly, because I could talk on this for hours and hours and hours, and you would just eventually be like, I have to use the bathroom and not come back. So, I'm going to point out maybe four or five passages, that's what I like to call them. I don't mean passages from the book, but I mean like passages that you pass through, liminal thresholds in the book. I'm just going to point them out and say, well, the book on one level is providing a little bit of a roadmap for what change can look like. What kinds of processes are involved if one's worldview is going to change? We talked about this in TalkBack. This is a great line from D.H. Lawrence who said, we would rather be ruined than changed. Right? The next line is, we would rather die in our illusions. So don't think just because, you know, you have an education and you have a lot of life experience that you're all about change, one part of you really, really, really resists that. Do you really want to say, I've been wrong for the last 20 years of my life, or fill in the number? No, we'd rather say, well, you know, I was mostly right. You know, I mostly got it, compared to other people, obviously. I mostly got it right. So we would rather be ruined than changed. So in a sense, the book of Jonah is presenting us a story where he gets ruined to see what he's made of, to see if he'll change. Sort of the divine puts him through this ordeal. So the kind of passages, the first two I'll go kind of quickly. It begins with a calling. All right, it begins with a calling. And the calling is very simple. Go to Nineveh. And I don't want to do a lot of background because I'm reading this more psycho-spiritually than sort of like with historical criticism, but here's one thing that you might want to know, which is the people of Nineveh were the enemies of the Jews. In fact, the people of Nineveh were Assyrians, and they came and attacked the 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel in the north and completely annihilated them, took them as slaves, and they never came back. They never came back to the land. They were completely decimated. 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel, this is in about 700 BC. So, obviously, the people of Nineveh, not well-liked. So, big-time challenge. Go over there, and Jonah says, no, no. He doesn't actually say no. He just goes in the opposite direction. All right. Joseph Campbell calls this refusing the call. It's part of the, in his mind, the hero's journey, the refusal of the call. Because, and think about calling this like this. What if the calling is as simple as, you're wrong about the way you see life, and you need to change. You're wrong about the way you see life. You need to change. You're wrong. You'd say, I'm going to go to Florida or wherever. You know, it's easier just to go away from that than to be confronted. So he goes in the opposite direction. And like all great stories, you know what's going to happen. It's just like, you know, people are surprised by the Adam and Eve story. Don't eat from that tree. It's almost like, okay, well, how long is it going to take? Right? Well, that's sort of like, that's what great myths and stories do. They give us a setup. So here's the setup. He goes in the opposite direction. A storm comes. And storms, of course, in the old world, in the ancient world, in the ancient ways, represent that part of nature or even divinity that you're not in control of. I drove home from Cadillac yesterday. My youngest daughter wanted to go skiing, and I drove home from Cadillac, and there's freezing rain on the windshield, and it kept, like, you know, freezing up, and it was a little bit dangerous. What could I do about it? Let me think. Nothing. Really, nothing. It's that stark reality that I'm not in control of my own life. And that's what happens. A storm arrives. The storm is what happens when you are not in control. And they all get together and, you know, and they're like, why is this happening? And there's a lot of bargaining, and bargaining is often part of the deal. Eventually they decide enough is enough. Jonah says, throw me into the sea. He's all into it. I just thought of it now. Like, his response to everything is, well, just kill me. All right, so... That's his response. They throw him into the sea, and this is maybe the second passage, which is being thrown overboard. Right? There's a calling, in this case, a refusal of the calling. The second passage is you're thrown overboard. Where you were going in life, what you thought was going to happen, I'm on my way to Tarshish, that's the place, and instead I'm thrown overboard. Now, just think about it for a moment. Have you ever been thrown overboard in your life? And when you're thrown overboard, you don't really know what's happening. You're in darkness, you're in water, you can't get back to the ship. You may want to. You may start swimming like, hey, let me back on, but you can't. All right? You're thrown overboard, and it's darkness. The underworld waits. You're not yet in the underworld. You're just in the chaos of the sea, and you're not sure what's happening. All you know is, well, what I thought was going to be the case, what I thought was the course for my life, what I thought was important, my body, my health, my family, whatever, it's all in question. And let me just add one quick layer, because I'm reading this a little bit more on the personal level, but you can also read the entire story as a symbol for collective groups, for example. What would be a global example of being thrown overboard of a ship? Oh, I know one, COVID-19. How we thought normal life was, the entire globe is experiencing being thrown overboard. Just like in the story. We thought we were going over here, but instead we got thrown over, and now we're all wearing masks. Or we're not wearing masks. But nobody is not talking about COVID. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it can be personal or collective. You can read it either way. That's passage number two. Passage number three is the underworld itself. My favorite topic, of course. The underworld. A great fish Jung says that fish are images of the unconscious, comes up and swallows Jonah and takes him down even further. You thought this was bad? Let's go all the way down to the abyss. Let's go all the way down. This is just like Geppetto in the belly of the whale. You know, it's the same thing. It's the underworld. It's the place of mysteries. This is the same pattern, by the way, that you have with Persephone. If you want a feminine example, Persephone's out there picking little flowers, smelling things, youth, innocence, and Hades, hell itself, comes up, snatches her, and takes her down to the underworld. All right? And down in the underworld, you're really in the mysteries. You're really asking, who am I? Who is God, if it's religious? Or what is the divine? What is nature? What is the meaning of life? You are down and you are in it. And there are no guarantees, just like that wind about to blow that door open. You're not in control of your own life. And you start to surrender, if you're lucky, to the mysteries. The funny thing about the Persephone story, by the way, is that Persephone, they finally make a deal. I won't tell you the whole thing, but Demeter's all upset, and they finally make a deal and say, okay, Persephone could spend half the year above ground and half the year below. It's a way of talking about the cyclical nature of reality. But Persephone has mixed feelings about coming back, because while she was down in the underworld, she tasted the sacred pomegranate seeds. She tasted something sacred down there. This is where all art and insight and mystery is born. And once you have a taste for that, you can never really go back. That's sort of what the story is saying. And the same thing happens with Jonah. When he's in the fish, in the bottom of the sea, in the belly, he starts writing a poem. Okay? He starts to respond differently to the world. Read the poem sometime, if you want. I'll give you a line. Here's the opening line of the poem. In my trouble, I called to the Lord, and he answered me from the belly of Sheol. This is the underworld, the belly of hell, you could say. I cried out, and you heard my voice. He's broken in a way. He's surrendering to suffering. So maybe you could say, suffering is a part of how we change. That came up in talk back. I mean, in pre-talk, which you should come to. Yeah, some kind of disruption, and he's suffering. And he's like, okay, well, I'm not in control of my own life. And suddenly, this is a place where poetry and insight is born. Passage number 4, he's spit out onto the new shore. He's not in control of being spit out, by the way. It's not like, well, I've got a time frame here, and you know, I'm thinking 3 days is probably good enough, and spit me out and I'll be on my way. There's no, if you've ever been to the underworld, if you've ever been thrown overboard and you've made it to the other side, did you do that? The story is saying, not really, not really. One day you're just on the other side and you're like, oh my God, I don't know how I got here. I have no idea how I got here. But I don't know if I can go back to how things were. I don't know if I can go back. My consciousness has been shifted. We hope. With Jonah, we have to say it's a little bit of a question mark. So he's gone through it. He's now on the other side. He's like, oh, fine, I go to Nineveh. Here's passage number 5, we could say. He goes to Nineveh. And he starts doing the thing that he was resistant to from the very, very beginning. He starts going around saying, you're going to die. You're going to die. God's not all that happy with you. And to his surprise, the people of Nineveh were like, you know what? We've gotten some things wrong as a society. Now, you don't really expect that in the story, really. I mean, imagine if I went to Congress and said, repent. They'd say, you know what, you're right. And they would all put on ashes and roll in the dirt and say, I've been so wrong. And the Republicans and Democrats would start hugging and they'd cry. And they'd say, you know what, we quit. We give it all to our children. You know, that would definitely happen. It's surprising. So Jonah's surprised. And then he gets angry about it. And he's like, I warned you. This is really what it says. He says, Jonah says to God, I warned you that you were compassionate. I knew it. I knew it all along that you were more kind than I am. And I didn't want this to happen. Because honestly, what do you want to happen to your enemies? Really? Now you say, well, I'm, you know, cosmos-centric and I, you know. Well, remember, you're all things. You can be egocentric and you can be ethnocentric. And when you're caught in that kind of energy field, what do you want done to your enemies? You know. Yeah. And that's what Jonah's feeling. He's like, this is unfair. It's unfair. So all he has to do is say, remember what they did? You know? Remember what the people of Nineveh did to the Jewish people? Remember, are you that blind? That's what he's saying to God. So Jonah goes up on a hillside. Here's the final part of the story. The final part of the story that ends with a question, which is where I'm going to end. He's up on a hill and a plant grows, the kikayon. And he's enjoying the shade. He's like, oh, I love the shade. You know, this is the best. I'm just going to wait here and hopefully God will change his mind and everyone will die in front of me. But in the meantime, I got a great view. All right, I've got the shade going. You know, sipping some lemonade, hanging out, just waiting to see what will happen. This is the greatest thing that's ever. And then the worm comes, eats the kikayon, and the next day he's like, I want to die again because the sun is too hot. So that's very egocentric. Do you feel how levels of consciousness are being pushed against here? It's about me and my shade. And that's what God is saying to him. How in control of the world are you? Are you really in control of nature? Do you have the right to be happy or sad about a vine? Can you make a vine grow or not grow? He's putting Jonah back into the position where hopefully some humility might happen and say, I'm not in control of my own life. I'm not in control of the natural world. I'm not even in control of my own happiness. My happiness was based on a plant that was there one day and tomorrow was gone. And then, you know, Yahweh asked the big question, which I'll end with. Should I not care about Nineveh, a city of 120,000 people who does not know their right hand from their left hand? And also many animals? That's my favorite line. And also many animals? Think about that as a question right now for our own ethnocentric universes. Should I not care about other people? 120,000 of them who do not know their right hand from their left. By the way, there's a level of judgment there. That's saying they could improve. It's not like everything is flat. It's no, you know, they're so blind they don't even know their right from their left here at this point. So, but should I not care about them? And also the animals? And this book, I think, sits right in the heart of the Hebrew Bible and raises this kind of question. Raises the question of common humanity. What do I have in common with the Ninevites? What does my consciousness have in common with their consciousness? What do we share in our humanness? That apparently, according to this book, the divine is more conscious than Jonah is at this point. The divine says, actually, I do care. I do care. I care about the people who don't know their right hand from their left hand, and I care about the animals. So, you could ask yourself a couple things. You could take it personally. How has my consciousness changed over the years? And is something like this pattern true? Down I go and up I come. The other thing we could ask is, do we need something like this right now? I mean, COVID-19, by the way, could be a collective way of digging in our heels and saying, my tribe has got it right as opposed to every other tribe. And you know what we kind of wish for them? You know? And the book of Jonah would say, all right, should we not care about 120,000 people who do not know their right hand from their left and also many animals? And that's where I'm going to leave it. Thanks for listening.